Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, on this last day of the year, we look back on some of the news stories and events that we covered in 2025. We chose segments of programs that we feel were among the most significant, including conversations with Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden and County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell about Border Patrol and ICE activities. We'll also listen back to part of a conversation with longtime but now retired County Manager Dina DiOrio. But we start with law and order. In the aftermath of the murder of Ukrainian immigrant Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line in August, an international spotlight was focused on Charlotte, and in the General Assembly, they quickly debated and passed Irina's law, which they say will make us safer and provide more resources for law enforcement, including the District Attorney's Office. But those additional resources fall short, and we spent some time talking about that and the challenges Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather and his fellow prosecutors face. So mental health and the availability of treatment is one problem. The other problem is that we do have in this jurisdiction and around the country, evidently, evidence of repeat offenders being out on the streets when perhaps some people would think they should be in jail. And this is how Donald Trump referred to this incident and the problem of criminals on our streets, even after multiple arrests during his recent video post.
She was slaughtered by a deranged monster who was roaming free after 14 prior arrests. We cannot allow a depraved criminal element of violent repeat offenders to continue spreading destruction and death throughout our country. We have to respond with force and strength. We have to be vicious just like they are. It's the only thing they understand.
What's your response to his remarks and his suggested approach to solving this problem?
My response is that in this office, that we have given special concentration in the way that we have proceeded against people who are repeat offenders and habitual felons, of using enhanced sentences to try to keep this community safe, and using the evidence that we have and partnering with law enforcement to make sure that we're holding people accountable. What it takes to have that happen is the strength of law. Where those enhancements exist, we use them. It takes evidence. Where that evidence exists, we use them. And we will use them to keep this community safe. But that does not absolve us of our responsibility to make sure that we are following the law. That does not absolve us of our responsibility to make sure that prosecutors are going into a court of law, making the arguments that the public expects from us. We will continue to do that. That is a responsibility that I've had as a prosecutor in this office for over 18 years, going on 19. And that's the very responsibility and obligation that I will hold going into this next year.
Here's something else that Trump said during that recent video release.
24 of the top 25 most dangerous cities in America are run by Democrat mayors, and it's time to stop this madness. The people of our country need to insist on protection, safety, law, and order. We'll do what has to be done because we're going to make America safe again, and that includes our big cities. We're going to make those cities safe.
It is true that 24 of the top 25 most populous cities are run by Democratic mayors, a list that Charlotte is on, but we are not on the list of the 30 U.S. cities that have the highest number of crimes. Yet he made that assertion when talking about us. Is he helping or hurting your efforts with comments like those?
My job and what I ask of all of the prosecutors that work in our office is that they keep their eye on the ball, they keep their hand on the plow, that they are focusing on the task at hand and not on politics, not who's a Democrat and a Republican. Because I can assure you that when a victim's family that has lost a loved one walks into this office, I am not asking them what party they belong to, and they sure aren't asking me. And so we want to make sure that we are concentrating on how it is that we're going to keep this community safe, how we're going to keep the public safe, and how we're going to make sure that they can depend on the law to keep them safe.
The mayor has received a lot of criticism about the way she and others on council have handled this incident. But recently she stated that this murder on the Blue Line, quote, was a tragic failure by the courts and magistrates. Our police officers arrest people only to have them quickly released, which undermines our ability to protect our community and ensure safety. That's a quote. You've spoken about this on this program in the past as well. And you've said that the courts are overburdened and underfunded, as is your office, the district attorney's office. How much of the problem that we face is due to the fact that stems from that, that the courts can't handle the load, nor can your office?
Without commenting on the actual, the killing of Irina Zaruzga, I can tell you, just as I have told you the many times that I've been on this program, we do not have what we need to govern and to uphold law in a city of this size and complexity. That's just the truth. Since 2010, this county has grown by 20%. And so we need to make sure that we are doing more, not just for prosecutors, but quite frankly, for judges, for courtrooms, magistrates. We are still in a system where just last year, the salary for magistrate judges just got raised to $56,000. They still do not have to be attorneys, which I think most people, when they find out that that's a reality, think that's crazy, especially in a city, again, with our complexity and facing the kind of challenges that we do.
And a lot of times, if I understand the system correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, magistrates are the ones deciding whether or not an accused defendant can be released on bond or have to serve some time in jail while awaiting trial. And last year, a WBTV report indicated that magistrates, they kind of back up what you just said, magistrates in the state, not just here, have few qualifications and little oversight, but more power than similar judicial officials in other states. Is that the case?
What we try to do with the Pretrial Integrity Act is make sure that we brought this stuff into the light of day. It's not just the fact that it's someone without a law degree who's making that decision. It's also the fact that it happens in the basement in a lower level of a detention center or a jail, that we want to make sure that victims are heard from. We want to make sure that prosecutors, quite frankly, are heard from. We want to make sure that police officers, law enforcement officers are heard from. And that currently isn't happening under our system. So if there's an opportunity out of all this to actually bring some a new level of review to how our systems work, I'm all for it.
2025 was the year the Trump administration sent National Guard troops and Border Patrol agents to mainly democratically controlled cities, including Charlotte. Here, they referred to it as Operation Charlotte's Web. There was little communication between federal and local authorities, and the result was fear and frustration, something we spoke about with Mecklenburg County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell.
I think this whole shock and awe show is for political purposes. And, you know, I think one reason that Charlotte is targeted, that North Carolina is being targeted, is because we have a very important Senate race coming up in 2026. And so, you know, anything you can do to smear local Democratic leadership or even leadership at our state level, that's what this president and this administration is going to do.
Which is what I anticipated. That's what I anticipated the answer to be. So let me flip the coin, because some Republicans have blamed the need for this operation on Sheriff Gary McFadden's refusal to cooperate in the past with ICE. To be clear, Sheriff McFadden has said he has been cooperating with them within the limits of the law, and that cooperation has in fact picked up since the legislature passed yet a new law to require more participation. He's following those mandates. What's your view on Sheriff McFadden's role in causing this incursion into Mecklenburg County?
Well, I think that's ridiculous. I don't think that he bears the responsibility for this. I think the responsibility is all at the federal level. And, you know, Sheriff McFadden is following the letter of the law, and that is what he has to do. And so I don't think that anyone can sort of say that he's brought this on because of, you know, anything that he has done. I think that he has stayed within the letter of the law. And when the General Assembly changes the law, he had to comply with that, and he has.
As you said in your proclamation, you point out that racial or ethnic profiling is unacceptable, unlawful, and inconsistent with constitutional guarantees like due process and the right to freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, both parts of the Constitution, both of which are being trampled or ignored here and in other cities targeted by the Trump administration. In your opinion, is this a lawless administration, or are they doing what they legitimately feel is necessary, as they insist, to keep Americans safe?
Well, I'm going to try to say this in the nicest way that I possibly can. That is BS. Okay. It is BS that this is for safety reasons. This is nothing to do with that. And I understand that, you know, this administration wants to scapegoat the Latino population. And I think that everyone who has an honest look at what the impact of Latinos is on our community, on our nation, anyone who's looking at it honestly knows that they have a positive impact and that this is all political theater meant to just gin up the base.
We also spoke about Operation Charlotte's Web with Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden, who has had a storied relationship with immigration enforcement, but has always said he merely follows the law. So there have been politicians who have tried to say that it was necessary to deploy Border Patrol to Charlotte because you, Sheriff McFadden, had not been cooperating with ICE. So let's clear that up. Can you say, without reservation, that you have been working with ICE so that accusation is outmoded?
That is a false accusation. North Carolina General Statute 162.62 mandates us by law to work with ICE to a cooperation. Now, when we go outside of the scope of the law, which ICE wants me to do without, you know, without having paper signed by a judge, I'm not going to do that. But we have been cooperating with ICE. I even sent a letter to ICE on October 1st, which they came to my office and we had a conversation of cooperation.
And even though they want you to cooperate with ICE, to my understanding, neither your department nor CMPD were asked to be part of any operations conducted by Border Protection. Is that correct?
That is correct. We had no ask, no even, we're going to be here. This is who we are. We can't even determine if they were ICE agents. It's just people in camouflage with guns.
You and others in local law enforcement have said that the activities that the federal government has been undertaking with regard to ICE and portraying as making our community safer have been doing the opposite. How would you characterize what has been taking place with Border Protection?
Completely opposite. Fear, anxiety, uncertainty, all of that comes into play. It wasn't making anything safer. It made it worse. And they claim that they were getting the worst first. Absolutely not. They showed us nothing about the worst first.
You know, you've been in law enforcement most of your life, your professional life. When you look at how the federal government is conducting these raids, and when you look at the laws that surround their ability to conduct these raids, how do you feel about that as a professional?
Well, I don't feel great about it as a professional because we never had a conversation. ICE has two federal laws that they could utilize. They did not. If you want to make your city safe and work within the law, you know, we have hundreds of warrants, unserved warrants inside the Mecklenburg County Detention Center or the courthouse that we could serve. So we could do a joint operation if to make our city safe. But this was beyond anything I have ever seen in my four decades of law enforcement, ever.
We continue our look back on 2025 in just a moment when Charlotte Talks continues.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're spending this last Charlotte Talks of 2025 by looking back on the year, reviewing some of the news and events we believe were significant, and revisiting conversations with some key players, along with other highlights of the program over the past year. We're going to hear from two of those key players right now. In July, longtime Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiIorio retired after more than 11 years on the job. At the time, she was about to be replaced in that position by her right-hand man, Mike Bryant, and we'll hear from him a bit later. But now, a part of our hour-long conversation with Dina, during which we talked about how she guided the county through the 2008 financial crisis, that COVID shutdown, and the time in 2017 when she refused to pay the ransom for a cyber attack on the county. You have been Mecklenburg County's manager since 2014, and one of the hallmarks of your approach to this job over the years has been the straightforwardness that you seem to present. You tend to tell it like it is. You don't sugarcoat the pill very much. Where does that come from in you? Is that the Northeasterner, the Connecticut, New Jersey, New Yorker in you?
Well, I think it's just easier. I mean, if you just tell it like it is, everybody knows where you stand, you know, and I think people appreciate people who are straightforward, and just, I don't know, that's just my personality. What can I tell you? That's how I am. I've always been like
that. You were the first woman to run Mecklenburg County. Channel 9 did a story about you in which they portrayed you as a barrier breaker. Is that how you view yourself, as a barrier breaker?
I think I've had the opportunity to do some really interesting and good work as Mecklenburg County manager. And so I think when you have the opportunity to sit in this chair, whether you're a female, male, whatever, you need to take advantage of the opportunity to really have a positive impact on your community. And that's what I've really tried to do as manager. And if that makes me a barrier breaker, then I'll take that.
You leave this job incredibly well respected by people you have dealt with. Last year, when the county commission was debating your pay rate for this final year on the job, Commissioner Vilma Leek said that she would give you $1 million if she could, because, quote, you need to know now and not later what people think about you. That strikes me as both rare and highly gratifying. What did that comment mean to you?
Well, it means everything. I mean, those kinds of comments, to know that, you know, my board respects me and they've given me so much latitude and so much trust to do good work. I feel incredibly fortunate and very blessed that I had the opportunity to work with this group of county commissioners, as well as all the commissioners that I've worked with since 2014. And I really believe that I'm leaving Mecklenburg County better than when I found it. I'm really proud of the work that I've done, that my team has done, that my employees have done. I think we're a high-performing organization. We believe in transparency and accountability, and we're relevant. I think Mecklenburg County is relevant. People want us to be at the table when important conversations are happening, and I'm really proud of that. I think we've done some really great things.
We have been known on this program, and other guests have been known on this program, to complain about the seeming lack of transparency at the city with the city. And I know the city and county are different entities with different responsibilities, but what's the downside? Is there a downside to being more transparent?
Never. I just don't see it. I think it's, you know, as a government, if you want people to trust you as a government, you have to be transparent and accountable. They have to know how their dollars are being spent. They have to understand how things work and the decisions that we're making and how we're making those decisions and why. And I believe that's the reason that we have as much respect as we do, because we are transparent. Public records requests, we respond to those as quickly as we can because we have nothing to hide. I mean, we're an open book here, and so we really believe that that's a critically important part of public trust.
You occupy the same building as the city. I'm wondering, why the difference in approach?
You know, everybody's got their different styles and different approaches to how they do the work. I do it my way, and, you know, my counterparts do it their way.
Will that continue under Mike Bryant's leadership, do you think?
I absolutely do think it will, because our board demands it. I mean, it's not, you know, I help facilitate that, but our board really believes in accountability and transparency, and they're going to expect that from Mike, just like they expected it from me.
You've had to deal with a lot as county manager. You'd have to go way, way, way back. I'm not even sure we had a county manager back when the 1918 flu pandemic hit Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. But no one in recent memory has had to deal with a pandemic that shut down the government, that shut down commerce, shut down the schools for almost a year. That had to have been an enormous challenge. Was it your biggest?
Absolutely. You know, there's no playbook on how to work or operate or manage during a worldwide pandemic. And, you know, very fortunate again, we had great partnerships and relationships with all of our partners. And I certainly didn't do it alone. We worked together every single day to make sure that we were in step and making sure that we were making decisions that we believe were based on data and science. And again, try to communicate as much information as possible, being transparent with the public about what was going on. You know, could we always do things better? You can always do things better. But I think, in light of the circumstances, I think as a community, we fared fairly well.
I'm not going to give away your age because that would be impolite, but you're retiring younger than most people do. And I know it's a stressful job, but why did you decide that now is the time to turn
So, in
the
case
hands
everybody's wondering, I'm 63, so
back?
I don't mind telling people how old I am. There was a few reasons. You know, first, we had a new leadership on our board, you know, Commissioner Jarrell and Commissioner Altman, younger leadership. They have a lot of energy. They want to do great things. And I really think that they should build the relationship with the county manager of the future and really work on those things that they want to work on. I really, you know, this is going to sound kind of weird, but I really feel that leading younger people, the younger generation, and how they work and how they want to work is very different than how I was brought up. And I think a younger leader will be more in touch to be able to lead a younger workforce. And I think that's critical for the county and to be successful going forward. So I thought about that quite a bit. And maybe some people don't know this, but my husband died when he was 68 years old, never collected a single Social Security check, never got to retire. And I made a commitment to myself that that was not going to be me and that I was going to retire when I was young and healthy enough to enjoy it. And so I'm doing that.
You told Eric Spanberg, our colleague with the Business Journal, that you have accomplished everything you wanted to accomplish in your career and that you have been very successful. There's no question about that. You've been recognized for your great work and for your leadership. I don't view that as boastful. I view that as fact. That must feel amazing, to be able to look back on a long career at doing many different things over time and perhaps not doing what you thought you would do when you were in college, and had your aspirations in front of you. What's it feel like to look back and be able to say that about yourself and your career?
Well, I mean, it's true. I really feel like I've had a tremendous impact here in Mecklenburg County. I feel like I had an impact on the other organizations that I worked for before I came here. I consider myself an impact player. When I show up to make change. That's how I'm wired. And you know, you get to a point where there's always going to be more to do, but it's okay to say, you know what, I'm going to let the next person you know, take it on and have some successes, and take the county and the organization to the next level. But I've had an incredibly great career and I've been very successful. And I'm very proud. I feel very proud of what I've accomplished.
What would you say to young people just starting out who would like to be able to say what you just said about yourself at the end of their careers when they decide to retire? What would you say about how to approach what they're going to go through in the next 40 years of their lives?
Well, there's always going to be ups and downs. And what I tell employees a lot, because we talk about this when I meet with employees, they always talk about wanting to get to the next promotion, to the next level. And I always say, you need to be great at the job you have today. If you're great at the job you have today, people will notice that. And I also tell them that relationships are critical, that people, you know, they always say it's not who you know, it's what you know, or what you know, who you know, but who you know matters. And having relationships with people and doing that networking is really very, very important. And so I tell people, be great at the job that you do today and build relationships with people. Go out, talk to people, explore, learn, work outside your comfort zone. Those are all the things that I think made me successful.
So we have about a minute left. When you decide, when you walk out the door and hand over the keys to Mike Bryant at the end of June, what's your plan? I'm just curious about what are you going to do all day?
Well, I don't know every day, but you know, I'm going to work on some nonprofit boards. I'm on the Dress for Success Charlotte board. I'm the secretary and the co-chair of the Capital Campaign. I'll be working on that. I'm still on the Alliance Health board. I'll still do that work. So that'll get me busy. I want to play a lot more golf. I want to exercise more. I want to learn how to cook. I want to travel.
Dina DiIorio left her position as county manager on July 1st and was succeeded by Mike Bryant. DiIorio praised Bryant as a strong leader who she had promoted and who had also worked with her predecessor, Harry Jones. And when Mike Bryant took the reins, we spent some time with him on this program, too.
I read an interview with you, and you said that ever since you set foot in the county, what is it, 22 years ago?
That's right.
You had your eye on this job. Why?
Mike, this is my dream job. Since January the 3rd of 2003, that was my first day in McLemore County. It has always been my goal to someday be the county manager. You know, I was able to acquire this position by being a product of my faith and family and fortitude. And because I've been with the organization for over 22 years and served in different capacities, you know, it allowed me to have perspective from different levels of the organization, from a front staff employee to a mid-level manager to a department director, as a member of Dena's executive team, as you've noted, and now as county manager. I believe those experiences over that 22-year span allows me to serve this community extremely well. And this is my home. You know, Mike, this is where my wife and I, we raise our kids. Our kids attend public schools here. We worship at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church as well. I love this community. I love our organization. And to be in a position, Michael, where I now have the opportunity to serve as county manager is unbelievable.
Yeah. She said many times on this program and elsewhere that she liked you. She admired you. She promoted you twice, I believe.
Yes.
Every time she got a promotion, she gave you a promotion. So clearly she was bringing you along or saw something in you that she thought had great potential. Well, now it's your job.
It is.
And everybody has their own style, their own way of doing things.
That's right.
So how would you describe your leadership style, and how will your approach differ from hers?
Well, I tell you, number one, both Harry and Dena, you know, I've had the privilege to work under some great leaders and the two of them and observe their success. Harry was already in the role when I came in. Mm-hmm. And then with Dena, I got to see her grow in the role. It takes time, you know, to get a good understanding of what it means to be county manager over an organization that has a $2.5 billion budget, 6,400 employees, and serve residents, what, 1.2 million residents. You're not going to know everything on day one. You're not going to know everything in the first year. You know, you certainly have to humble yourself. And a lot of the attributes that Dena and Harry both possess, I intend to take those with me. However, my tenure as manager is going to be mine. Because of Dena's experience and how she's evolved over that 10-year run as our manager, obviously she's very direct, very front. You know where she stands, very transparent. I applaud her for that. I think with me, as a new manager, I'm going to be a little more collaborative. I'm going to lean in on the subject matter experts a lot more as I build my capacity as manager as well. So certainly it's going to be underscored with being more collaborative.
I actually was surprised to hear you say that you're not going to know everything on the first day, because you didn't come in cold from Saskatchewan.
Oh, no.
You've been here
all
for 22 years, and you were in the executive team
that
Dena assembled, and you were there for a long time, 22
yeah.
years. So you know where the bodies are buried. What surprised you most when you took over the reins and you faced your first couple of major decisions? What surprised you about this that you didn't anticipate?
It's a pleasant surprise. You know, as I transitioned into the role, the board appointed me back on April 1st. And Dena's last day in office was June 5th. So it gave me some runway to divide and conquer with Dena. And what I did, Mike, was I initiated these listening tours across the entire community, Mike, where I met with leaders from the corporate community, philanthropic, the faith community, nonprofits, the hospitals, sports, entertainment. I've lost count. I've had over 70 individual meetings. And the one thing that I would categorize as a pleasant surprise, Mike, is the interest to come together and collaborate for the good of this community. I'm so impressed and appreciative with the leadership across the entire Charlotte-Mecklenburg region and their interest to do just that. And we're going to come together in November and talk about how we can collaborate.
I was going to talk about this listening tour a little bit later, but since you brought it up, let's talk about it now. Who came? How many people did you talk to? Who did you listen to? How did they know to come and talk to you?
Well, fortunately, Dina, as part of her mentorship and support of me transitioning into the role, she provided me with a list of names of individuals that I should meet, that I need to get to know, and certainly their influences in this community. Some of those individuals, you know, being here 20 years, I knew them. However, I know them, but I recognize also being manager, it's a different conversation. And Mike, I can certainly not expect, you know, the relationship I had with those individuals as budget director or deputy county manager to be the same now that as I assume the role as county manager. So I met with CEOs from the banks, the hospitals, the nonprofits, pastors from very prominent churches. I met with just folks from the streets, off the streets, our neighbors, our residents as well, because I think it's so important to just listen.
So what did you hear? What were people telling you?
What I heard is concerns, obviously, regarding transportation, affordable housing, jobs. There's concerns about workforce development as well. So a host of things. But in addition to that, they're certainly appreciative of accomplishments that we've made as an organization as well. One of the things that I've heard consistently, particularly from the corporate community, is the need for the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County to work together.
We're sharing some memorable moments of 2025 on this program in the last year this hour, and we will continue in 90 seconds. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. From time to time, some famous and influential individuals find their way to our microphones, and recently astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson filled that bill. We had a wide-ranging conversation about the thing that really turns him on the most, outer space. And we spent some time talking about the myriad opportunities for life somewhere else out there. When we think about life, we think about ourselves. We live within certain temperature ranges. We must have water. We must have
liquid water.
We must have a food supply, oxygen to breathe. Is it possible in your mind that there are other forms of life that don't need any of that?
All the microbes in your gut thrive in the absence of oxygen, okay? And their byproduct is methane and hydrogen sulfide, H2S. Hydrogen sulfide is why your gaseous effluences are unpleasant for others to smell, okay? And so there's life forms on Earth that not only don't want oxygen, the oxygen environment is hostile to them. So that's one example. Another is, on Earth, we have what are called extremophiles, which are life forms that thrive in conditions that would otherwise kill us or any sort of room temperature loving life on Earth. So, you know, polar bears do the backstroke in 31 degree salt oceanic waters. Okay. If I put you in there, you're dead 15 minutes later. To me, that counts as a range of conditions under which you would find life. There's life forms in the many places on Earth, but a highly studied one. There's what we call black smokers. It's a place like off the coast of Oregon and Washington. the Juan de Fuca Ridge, where the hot magma from below Earth's crust is sort of gurgling up. It's heating the water. That's an energy source. There are life forms at the bottom there that thrive on geochemical energy and not on solar energy, because we ultimately are driven by solar power, because we plants get energy from the sun. We eat plants and or we eat animals that eat the plants. So we are ultimately solar powered. These are life forms that are not. And so the study of extremophiles on, oh, one other place. There's Lake Vostok in Antarctica. This is a body of water completely covered in ice. Okay, but it remains liquid down there, and it hasn't seen air. It hasn't seen anything. I forgot, over hundreds of thousands of years. And so this is a laboratory, that's the wrong word. It's a repository of whatever was thriving back then, untouched, uninfluenced, unharmed by anything going on today. Not any of the nuclear fallout, none of the pollution. And if there are life forms that are down there, maybe they're very different from what we find up here. So the whole study of extremophiles is food, if I may use that word, food for the study of alien life elsewhere. And you want to know, can we communicate with them? Here's a question for you. Can you meaningfully communicate with chimpanzees? I think the answer to that is no. Okay? Meaningfully. I mean, oh, I'll meet you at 4:30 tonight. Let's go out to dinner at, you know, and get a coffee at Starbucks, and I'll meet you. No. These are simple sentences that any human can understand, simple gestures. No, you can't. The smartest chimp cannot be taught long division, okay? It's just certain things that just put a line and say, it's not happening. And the chimp is the closest genetic relative we have on Earth. You're going to go to an alien and think you're going to have a conversation with it? If we are to the alien what chimps are to us, forget about it. They will scratch their head. Do they have heads? I don't know. They never have hair. You ever notice that? We never give them with hairdos. Aliens are always bald. But I don't know why, but for once, I want an alien with a hairdo. Okay.
It's because they have to. They can't leave their hair products at the airport when they leave in their spaceships. They have to.
That's what it is. Wait. Let me just finish that point. So the alien will see us, and we would probably be, if they're smarter than us, by any amount, really. I mean, to get here by spaceship, it kind of presumes that, because we haven't left low Earth orbit since 1972, and they crossed the galaxy to arrive here. So they probably cannot conjure a simple enough thought for us to comprehend.
So that leads me to this, because we've sent space probes out, long-term space probes, on which we've put discs of recordings of various human activity, and we've put messages in writing, et cetera, on these things, I guess thinking that if an alien being finds this, they will be able to understand us. And it would seem that if we're looking for intelligent life, they may not be able to communicate with us either, even if they're highly intelligent. So let's talk about these unidentified flying objects. We no longer call them that, but last year, or during the last waning days of the Biden administration, the Defense Department released videos of fighter pilots who were finding what we used to call UFOs on their radar screens, moving in a manner at which we cannot duplicate and at speeds that we cannot achieve. What's your theory about that?
It's a mystery.
Were they alien spacecraft?
No. Wait. Just to be clear. Just because you don't know what you're looking at, it doesn't mean you know what you're looking at. Okay? You can't use the absence of knowledge of this mysterious thing on the screen and use that as evidence that you know what's on the screen. All right, the U in UFO, which was rebranded UAP by the government, I think to reduce the giggle factor, but I was perfectly fine with UFO, unidentified anomalous phenomenon. forgot what the A stands for. It used to be unidentified aerial phenomenon. Anyhow, but it's a substitute for UFO. If it's unidentified, it's unidentified. Period. Okay? The universe brims with mysteries. It's okay to say, I don't know what this is. If you're going to say, it's an alien, what based on what? Because you don't know what it is, therefore it's an alien? No. No. By the way, of all the things it could be, aliens would be last on my list. Because that's an extraordinary explanation, which requires extraordinary evidence. And not just a fuzzy tic-tac doing things on a F-18 fighter pilot screen. That's not extraordinary evidence. That's weird thing in the detector evidence, okay? Extraordinary evidence would be the alien walks up to the White House, okay? Or something that doesn't show up fuzzy in front of some people. Why is it that we have 6 billion smartphones in the world, each capable of obtaining high resolution, sharp video and audio and pictures, and the best evidence we have for aliens visiting are fuzzy tic-tacs seen by a couple of fighter pilots? Why? I don't get it.
Yeah.
We should have way better evidence than that. And consider Area 51, where we're surely stockpiling all of our aliens. The janitor, okay? No one has snuck out a photo from in there? That hasn't happened yet. Yeah, if a janitor does it, the janitor loses his job overnight. But he'll be the most famous, richest janitor there ever was the next day. And that's never happened, really. I got one for you. In the Ben Franklin's, what that thing that he published?
Almanac.
Poor Richard's Almanac. Yeah, one of his issues, he has some quotes. He's a very quotable guy. One of them is, 3 people can keep a secret if 2 of them are dead. <That's>... So all this thing, there's a cover-up and thousands of people are in the cover-up. That's not how humans work. I'm sorry. And the same people who are certain there's this masterminding government cover-up, generally those are the same people who will say on another day, the government is this bloated, inefficient system, and it should all be, you can't have it both ways. You can't have a bloated, inefficient system that is masterminding a cover-up with hundreds, and in some cases, thousands of people.
Science fiction, from which a lot of the things that we have today have come to pass, for instance,
I would say fewer than people think when they make that statement, but yes. The answer is yes. But so way less than you think.
In science fiction, whether it's a book or a film, usually aliens are to be feared because they're here to harm us, except maybe the day the Earth stood still. They didn't seem to want to harm us. They wanted us to de-arm and warn us about nuclear weapons. But aliens are always to be feared. And maybe there's a reason to fear them, even if they don't mean us harm, because when European explorers came to the North America continent, a lot of indigenous people died because of diseases for which they were not prepared. Could that happen?
By the way, they were colonists, not explorers, just to be clear.
But
yeah.
Could that happen, even if we find a rudimentary life forms on some other planet or moon? Could exposure to that expose us to things that we have no defenses for?
Yeah. So the 2 separable variables there. One is, like I said, you're an explorer if you gather data and you just leave things the way they are. Columbus was not an explorer, and none of the people in that era were explorers. They carried flags of Spain to declare land for the king. So that's not exploration. That's a very important distinction that a scientist would make relative to conquistadors and anybody else who's trying to conquer the world. That's A. B, you are correct. When you have any population that has lesser technology than one that arrives, it has never boded well for the civilization that had lesser technology, ever. Okay? So So I'm agreeing with you there. Now about diseases and microbes and other things, there's an entire branch of NASA called the Department of Planetary Protection. Okay? Planetary Protection. That makes sure, their goal is to make sure that in our probes that we send out, we do not forward contaminate where we're going with microbes that somebody sneezed onto the spacecraft before they got launched. Because it might be a place where we'd one day want to look for life. And you don't want to discover the COVID virus or the rhinovirus that we put there and then somehow contaminate our data thinking that that was formed on the planet of your destination. So there's that. Also, there are protocols for what you do when an object returns to Earth. It's kept in quarantine. It's very antiseptic in the environment in which it's placed. So there are protections in place for that. Now, consider, however, that we don't know how aliens would treat us. Aliens that are smarter with greater technologies. But we do know how we treat each other. So these depictions of aliens as hostile, to me, is more the fear of how we know we would treat ourselves based on actual evidence rather than any knowledge we would have of how aliens would treat us because no such knowledge exists. So it's really fear of ourselves. It's a mirror. Their behavior to us, I see that as a mirror of our own behavior.
What do you think would happen if we found life? This would clearly change a lot of traditional thought, religious and otherwise, about who we are and why we are here and what our place in the universe is. So how would we react to it? Would it be greeted with the same kind of skepticism that we see climate science being greeted at? Would there be an attempt to distance ourselves from a truth that you folks as astrophysicists have uncovered? What do you think would be the end result?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've thought a lot about that, but I don't claim that my answers are definitive or they're the answer. Surely there are other nuances that others can bring. There are some branches of religion religious sects that require that humans be the one and only object of God's creation with nothing permitted elsewhere in the universe. And so there'd be some denial at first, for sure. If the life form is decidedly and obviously, quote, lesser than us in intellect and in power and ability, that doesn't really pose a threat to anybody's preeminence. But if they're clearly smarter and clearly more powerful, then people have to contend with that. Because if religious people would have to somehow factor that in or give up their religion entirely. Because did God make them? And if he did, he prefers them because they're more powerful than us. And they can control us. They can enslave us. They can turn us into their pets. So who is the God of humans who also made that? Do they have a God? I mean, it totally stirs that pot of thinking, and they're going to have to resolve that, okay? So that's the first part of it. As for the rest of society, there'd be intriguing biological questions. How is its identity encoded? Is it DNA? DNA is a very complex molecule. Can you make that twice on one planet and on a whole other planet? Or does life find some other way of being alive not represented here on Earth? Here's an interesting analogy. Geologists are comfortable in almost any planetary surface because they've studied what minerals and molecules do under heat, under pressure, when they solidify. They have a sense of that. They may be less familiar with them on another planet. They might be more mineral-rich, whatever, but they're not looking stupefied at what's in front of them.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. And that concludes our look back on 2025. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Talks will be back in the new year. We have no idea what we may talk about, but with your support, we'll be here to bring whatever comes our way to you in 2026.
In the meantime, from all of us here at Charlotte Talks and WFAE, Happy New Year.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.